Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO, and it's my pleasure to welcome back to the program today Andre Debuse III. His memoir, Townie, has just come out in paperback. He joins us on his ancient cell phone from somewhere in the Twin Cities area. Welcome back, Andre.
Thanks, Vic. It's good to be back.
I have that same brand of cell phone, and you know, I don't normally allow cell phone interviews, but you're the one exception.
I appreciate it. You better hurry up, though, because it's working on mule fuel.
Okay. Your new book, Townie, is a departure for you because this is your first work of nonfiction, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I've written some personal essays over the years, but yes, the first nonfiction book. That's right.
And Townie, when I hear the word Townie, I can remember the first time I heard it, and it's kind of a derogatory term, isn't it, Andre?
Yeah, that's how I always heard it. And, you know, it tends to be there are a couple of meanings, but the primary one is, you know, blue-collar guys and gals living in a town where there's a college where kids from out of town go to school. So you're the ones who go across the wall there to hang out with them and drink and chase girls and boys. But, you know, you're the lower class. You're the townies. And I was one of them.
And this is the story of how you became a writer and how you had this complicated relationship with your father, who was also a writer. In fact, for a major portion of this book, your dad's the writer and you're the fighter.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very well said. Yeah, you know, you and I have talked about this before, Vic, but the thing that I really love about writing is how it really takes you to places of exploration you couldn't have consciously foreseen before you sat down with your pencil. And I had no intention that I'd be writing about my father. I had no intention that I'd be writing about writing. But yeah, I was a little kid. We moved around a lot. My mom was a single mother in poverty with four kids. You know, my dad wasn't living high in the hog by any means. He gave us probably half of his income, and he was poor too, but he lived on a college campus and had a much different life than we did across the river in the more blue-collar neighborhoods. And I got beat up a lot until I snapped and became a fighter, and I did that for about 10 years, and thank God stopped doing that.
So you have stopped. You're not going to be fighting anymore, huh?
No, I'm a recovering pugilist, Vic.
Okay.
One day at a time. I haven't had a fight in 25 years.
Okay. Now, what was the last one, at the airport in Miami?
No, it's the one in the book, that man who was punching his wife in the face with his fists.
Uh-huh.
That's the last guy I fought. And you know from having read it that, you know, I want people hearing this to be clear. I'm no fan of violence. I hate it. I was a victimized kid, and then I learned to be a victimizer. But I would only go after, you know, guys being mean to smaller men or women. And that's the only way I could morally defend getting violent. But I really did that, and hopefully that's clear in the book, more for me, I think. I think I was still just trying to exercise that scared little boy I was.
And your dad was mostly absent, so you really lacked that in your life, didn't you?
Yeah, you know, but I have to say, you know, some reviewers have referred to my father as having abandoned the family. He didn't abandon us in the way that some fathers do when they drive away, you never see them again, and there's no money for the mother. You know, we saw him every Sunday. He picked us up, took us out to dinner or a movie if he could afford it. But it was very much a 70s divorce situation. You know, we never spent the night even once at any of his apartments. We didn't have any phone contact during the week. So yeah, he was not nearly as present a father as you know, I get to be. And when I wrote the book, I was really surprised that his absence in my boyhood became a really big presence in the book.
And your mom worked so hard, and yet it was so difficult. The refrigerator was bare a lot of the time, wasn't it?
It really was. I mean, I think I have this in the book of. A friend came over once with a case of beer, and we just opened the fridge. You just pushed it right in. I mean, there was just nothing in the way. It was just bare shelves. And, you know, there are a lot of us, sadly, who grew up that way. And also, my mother was of a class we don't talk about much, which is, you know, she was a member of the educated working poor. You know, she had a bachelor's degree. She worked in social services, but she made barely over $100 a week, and she had four kids. It was not easy.
This is also a story about your siblings and the difficult times that they were having growing up in this situation. Tell us about this town you were living in.
Well, the town is Haverhill, Massachusetts, on the Merrimack River, just east of Lowell, that the film The Fighter made famous and also Kerouac made famous. Lawrence is just upriver. It's a town of mill towns. I mean, it's a river of mill towns. It's a valley of places that they used to be big in the 1890s, early 1900s, but our town, Haverhill, was called Shoe City because at one time they were producing 90% of the shoe soles in the country. But then Italy started to export shoes a lot cheaper, and they were better made, and the town went belly up. And when we came along in the 70s, you know, downtown was abandoned. It was just, there's a lot of drug and alcohol use, and the neighborhood I lived in, and we spent time in, you know, there were a lot of biker gangs and, you know, poverty and welfare and food stamps and just kind of destitute, desperate people. And those are the people I grew up with. And, you know, there's a lot of everyday violence and, you know, a lot of fighting and a lot of unhappiness. And I was a little kid who got beat up a lot. And I allowed that until I didn't anymore. And then that's when I snapped and changed.
And we get a lot of snapshots of you working out. You became quite a physical fitness buff, and you bulked up. I was starting to get suspicious you were taking steroids.
Yeah, no. Well, you know, sadly for me, I never got big. I mean, I got so much stronger than I ever was. And, you know, I was able to bench press 100 pounds over my body weight at one point, and I did all sorts of things that you never would think. I mean, I look like a guy who played tennis. I never got big. My sons, ironically, are huge. I wanted to be them, but I got really strong, and much to my surprise, I had athletic ability, and I developed a knockout punch, and I used it, you know, whenever I felt I needed to, and, you know, writing got me off that path, which is interesting to me.
I loved it when you describe how this guy at the gym showed you how to do it, and he talked kind of funny, didn't he?
Yeah, he's dead now, and I really miss him. But yeah, he talked like this for the Escher's. He had one of those strange, I don't know if it's the lisp or what, or if he'd just gotten punched in the face a lot. But all of his S's sounded like SH's. And I remember once he said, after I punched the bag a lot harder than he thought I ever could, he said, "Wow, Andre, you are a lot stronger than you look." I felt both proud and ashamed at the same time.
So was it rage that motivated you? Was it revenge? You say you were defending people that were weaker and et cetera, but it got to the point where there were these feuds, where these gangs of brothers would be looking for you, and you were always getting warned, like, they're going to get you. What was it? Was it fear? Was it rage, anger?
You know, I'm so glad you asked, because I learned something writing that book, and I think that's the whole point. It's again, this act of discovery writing is. For years I thought, okay, I was a far more effective street fighter than I had any right to be, because I'm not a big, tough guy. But I was an angry guy, and I was so angry, I was very dangerous. But, you know, it wasn't just anger. You know, you're talking about my having to write about my family. Well, in the first drafts, I left out a lot of my family because I didn't want to violate their privacy. And then I realized I wasn't writing as honest a story as I should. So I went more deeply into the fact that my brother's being sexually abused in the house by a grown woman from his school, that he was suicidal. My sister had been gang raped. She was selling drugs for a while. My other sister was depressed. My mother was overwhelmed and exhausted. My father wasn't around. And there was no larger clan. All the rest of our relatives were 2,000 miles away in Louisiana. And really, it's all of that that I was putting into my fists in these fights, on top of the rage, the bullied boy I'd been. But, you know, it was writing the book that taught me that. There are a lot more layers to it than I had been conscious of.
The book is Townie. Andre Dubuque III wrote it. Just came out in paperback. I think one of the most stunning pieces of the book, and I'm guessing this was hard to put in there, was the Thanksgiving dinner where your mom had cooked up all the food and you were waiting for your dad to come by, because he always had Thanksgiving with you. He'd always sit down for two or three holiday meals with you every year. And he was supposed to be there at 3 o'clock and he didn't show up and he was late. And when he finally shows up, he's got this guy with him.
Yeah.
And what happens at that dinner?
Well,
that was bizarre.
Yeah, it was bizarre. So I had long hair halfway down my back and blonde hair. And, you know, it took me a while before I started to grow whiskers. So here I am about 15, 16, and I've been, you know, working out for about a year, and I no longer feel like the soft, sedentary little boy I was. And this guy was really drunk and dying of leukemia. They were both pretty drunk. And he sat next to me, and he's coming on to me. I think he thinks I'm some pretty little girl. And before I know it, he's got his tongue in my mouth right there at the Thanksgiving table. It was horrible. And you know, I got up and went outside, and, you know, and my father came out and was trying to explain to me that, you know, this guy wasn't gay. It was so uncomfortable. And, you know, I've gotten a lot of response about that scene. The truth is, you know, not everybody has a Thanksgiving moment like that, but everybody has bad holiday dinners with family. I mean, there's always, I mean, people really relate to that scene because I don't know what it is about Christmas or Thanksgiving that brings out the worst in people, but sometimes it really does, sadly.
Well, I thought your dad's explanation was right on. It made sense that this guy was dying and you represented life.
Yeah.
He wanted some of that life.
Yeah, I thought that was a wise, I agree.
I
sure as hell didn't want to give it to him, you know?
Yeah. Your relationship with your dad was very complicated, and this is really wonderful to read about your relationship and how you kind of got to know him as you got older. He'd been away, and the two of you got to spend some time together, and in a way, he kind of helped you make that transition to become a writer, didn't he?
Well,
he encouraged you.
Well, yes, he encouraged me, but I would have kept writing even if he hadn't because, you know, as you know, one of the ways I tried to control my street violence was I started to box. I said, well, you know, I'll just box, and that's when I'll be throwing punches and I'll stop getting in these fights. And one night, instead of going to the gym, I sat down and something made me sit down and write a scene. I still don't know what made me sit down. It makes me, frankly, believe in the divine. And I was, you know, I felt so much like, I felt like myself for the first time after that writing session. And a few months later, I finished my first short story and, you know, it was terrible. But I didn't care. I just felt like me. And you're right. My father, once he began to read my early stuff with three or four other people whose opinion I trusted, he was very generous. He called me a writer, 15 years before I would ever say that to anybody about me. And he was very, very generous, very supportive in that way. He was actually very generous to every young writer always. He was, you know, he had some, as flawed a man as he was, he had as many angels as he did demons. And that should be noted.
And your dad had his own reputation, and he was really known for his short stories. And you talk about the revelation of reading his stuff and realizing who he was.
Yeah, I remember I was about 19 or 18, and I had read only his only novel was his first book called Lieutenant, which came out in the 60s, and I read that when I was about 15. But when I was about 18, 19, I read his story Killings, and which, by the way, went on to become the Academy Award-nominated film In the Bedroom, which my father never got to see because he died before it came out. But I read Killings, and I remember I had just read The Grapes of Wrath a few weeks before, and that was the first piece of literature that really kind of took my head off and made me believe in the power of literature. And after I finished my father's 21-page story, Killings, I felt that he had done something as powerful as Steinbeck had done with 500 pages, and I remember went for a walk, and I just had the insight, well, this is where my dad's been my whole life. He's been in these, between the pages of these books with these other people, you know, these imaginary people. But, you know, I actually, my respect went up for him because he was so good at it, and I thought, well, that's where he's been. All right, I get it.
And your dad, of course, was Andre Debuse as well.
Right.
And as we we learn about your complicated relationship with your dad, and we get to the point where the two of you are hanging out together some, and you're going to school where he's teaching, and you actually got to learn some things about him, like the time you got his ticket to the Red Sox game, and you're like, wait a minute, you figured out that your dad had been a Red Sox fan, but you never even knew it?
Yeah, that was kind of painful. He'd always gone to Red Sox games, but I didn't know that. And he went to every opening day at Fenway Park, and, you know, he'd never taken us. And I hate to say that out loud on the radio because it makes him sound terrible, but it's still a mystery to me why he didn't take us. I think he was always broke, so maybe he didn't have the money to bring all four kids. He couldn't just bring one or two. Or maybe it was just that was, you know, he compartmentalized his life. You know, that was part of his life. Our life was really that Sunday afternoon thing. I don't know, but, yeah, so he was sick, so he called me and said, hey, why don't you take your friend to Fenway Park? And I didn't even know where that was. I was 19 years old. So I went with my friend, he's Sam in the book. His real name's Bill. And we go to Fenway Park, and I'm 19 years old. It's the very first baseball game I've ever seen in my life. I never watched one on TV. I never played a game. I never saw a Little League game. And here I am, 19, and my friend is quietly explaining to me all the rules of baseball, and he's doing it quiet so, you know, he doesn't embarrass me in front of all these Red Sox fans. And, yeah, that was strange. And my brother, too, fell through the cracks with the sports. We were just so, you know, all these sort of perfect storm factors were lined up for us for that to have happened. You know, all our relatives were down south. There were no uncles, no cousins. We moved so much. There were no coaches, no teachers, always the new kids. And we had very few friends for a while, so there were no parents of kids. And we spent a lot of time alone, sometimes roaming the woods, building things. And we just fell through the cracks and didn't know anything about sports. And to this day, I'm telling you, my 51-year-old brother has no idea that the New York Giants beat our team in the Super Bowl.
It's not on his radar.
Not on his radar.
Yeah.
Which I think is kind of cool, but it's on mine. My sons are what brought me to baseball and football. I love these games now. I'm just like a regular guy now.
Andre Dubuque III joins us. His book, Townie, his memoir, just came out in paperback. And I got to say that there's certain things in this book where I'm reading it, and I was like, you've got to be kidding. Like the time the woman said to you, well, I'm from Manhattan, and you said, where's that?
Yeah.
You led a sheltered life in a way, didn't you?
Well, I kind of like a feral wild child life, you know? I mean, but, you know, I got to tell you, it's not uncommon, I think, in a lot of blue-collar neighborhoods for someone not to know something like Manhattan. I mean, where would I have heard? I probably heard of the cocktail before, but I just, you know, I was ignorant. I didn't read books. We had three channels on the TV, and yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty stunning, wasn't it? I mean, some guy wrote me and says, there's no way. I don't believe you didn't know. You'd never heard of Manhattan at 18. But I hadn't. I had not.
And your dad, another thing that comes through very, very strongly in this book is his profound appreciation for a pretty woman.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he loved women, and he couldn't stay loyal to save his life. He'd be the first to tell you that. And, you know, my brother and I were talking a year or so ago, kind of, you know, busting his chops when he's not here to defend himself. We would have done it in front of him, too. He said, you know, what's so hard about being monogamous? You know, what's so hard about staying married? But, yeah, he was a woman chaser. And they loved him. They loved him. Why wouldn't they? He was charming and charismatic and talented and good-looking and, you know, even in his wheelchair the last 12 years, he didn't lose any of his swagger. He was just as sexy as he ever was.
I had never heard the details of that accident until I read your book, and that's just really tragic.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, he stopped on the highway to help someone, and he got run over and crippled the rest of his life. He's been in a wheelchair. And I think I'll go into the book, too, don't I, that, you know, he grew so much spiritually. I'm not suggesting people go out there and get maimed to grow spiritually, but there's a wonderful line from the French writer Léon Bloy, And it's actually an epigraph to a Graham Greene novel I was reading the days after my father's sudden death at age 62. And here's the line: man has places in his heart which do not yet exist, and into them enters suffering in order that they may have existence. And that certainly happened to my old man. And I think it frankly happens to a lot of us. You know, the truth is, it was a scrappy childhood I had, like millions of others of people. My story's not unique. But frankly, I think that tough beginning did some things for me as an adult that I should be grateful for.
Is it apropos to say that you were raised in the land of no?
Yeah. Did you read that essay?
I did.
Oh, cool.
I think it dovetails nicely with the book and with what's going on in the world today.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah. So what you're referring to is this essay I just published in the New Republic about inequality. And you know, it's interesting, Vic, I actually had some of that in Townie. I had a very beautiful and very wealthy girlfriend in my 20s for a few years. And it was with her that I realized just how poor we'd been with our mother, how little we had when I saw how much my girlfriend grew up with. The contrast was very educational. And I cut all that out of the draft of Townie, and it made me think about the difference between autobiography and memoir. You know, an autobiography is a life story, and who cares about my life story? I'm just a guy who writes books from Massachusetts. But if I were some former president, et cetera, you'd be more interested. A memoir, you know, you and I could write 20 about our lives. You could, you know, a memoir is focused on one aspect of experience. You know, it could be a summer, it could be a bad thing, you know, on and on. And so I cut out the rich girlfriend stuff because there's only so much you can drag a reader through in a memoir. Mm. As opposed to an autobiography. But I'm glad you read that, and I'm glad I published that this week.
I think you could just plug it right in. I mean, it seemed to me like, oh, this is something that didn't make it into the book.
You're exactly right. It was an outtake.
Yeah.
You know what I was kind of sad I didn't keep in the book was, you know, every now and then to get away from the mill town life, we would go visit my mother's family down in Louisiana, but we couldn't afford to fly there. We couldn't even afford a bunch of bus tickets, so my mother would get paid to drive repo cars to New Orleans, and then we had enough money to get a bus in New Orleans to the little camp where her parents lived in central Louisiana. I kind of like that repo detail.
I did too. I read it and I said, I don't remember this being in the book.
Yeah, it should have been.
Yeah, that's great stuff.
I'll put it in the movie.
Okay. Andre Dubuse III joins us. His memoir, Townie, just came out in paperback, and you have a relative, I believe he's your cousin, who I've had on this program a dozen times. I love him.
James Lee Burke. I love him too.
And he's got a blurb, and he doesn't do many blurbs, but I know he did this one for you because he knows you and he loves you. And I got to say, this is probably the sweetest blurb I've ever seen, because he says, quote, "I sincerely believe Andre Dubuse may be the best writer in America." Now, how can you possibly live with such adulation, Andre?
Well, I am immensely grateful to him. He's, you know, he's been one of my favorite writers since I was a kid. He's an immense craftsman and artist, and I love him. He's also a gentleman, and I don't take it in. I'm grateful, and it goes in one ear and out the other. I actually don't let in any praise. You know, but writers are funny. But I'll let in a bad review. I will not let in something really laudatory. But if someone goes after the book, I'll believe, okay, now that one, I don't know why we do that to ourselves.
So a bad review has credence with you?
Well, I don't read reviews anymore because, there's a lot to learn from them, and I'm grateful that someone's taken the time to read the book and write about it. But I find that it puts me in such a state of self-consciousness. And I really think, and Vic, you and I may have talked about this before, I think if there's any one enemy to human creativity or, you know, bouncing a basketball for that matter, it's self-consciousness, right? Where you got one eye in the mirror to see how you're doing. Mm-hmm. And so I find I don't read book reviews of anyone. I don't read the New York Times. I don't check out what other writers are up to. I read their books, But I find that whole scene is just, it just makes me too career conscious, and then it makes me too self-conscious when I'm, I mean, literally self-conscious, where I'm consciously thinking about what someone said as I'm writing something new, and then I'm out of the moment. So I just don't look at all at any reaction. Somebody asked me, what do you think of your reaction to Tony? I said, I don't know. I don't know what it is. Is it good?
Good for you.
Yeah, well, that's how I'm protecting myself, really.
Well, that's how you keep whatever it is that's inside you there, right?
Well, I think so, you know, and I talk about this with my writing students. I mean, there's being an author on one hand and a writer on the other. And I, you know, I teach a 14-week course, and I reserve the last 15 minutes of the last three-hour class of the last week to talk about publishing. The entire semester is, hey, look, if you don't get this work done, don't even think about publishing because you got to write the book first. So anyway, I try not to think about career. I mean, right now I'm an author because I'm on a book tour.
Mm-hmm.
But most of my life at home, I'm just Andre the writer in my soundproof cave in my basement with my pencil and my notebook.
Well, Andre, the last time I talked to you, I remember your modus operandi for doing an interview was you would climb into your pickup truck and you would leave the house.
Yeah, yeah.
And we interviewed you from your pickup truck. How's your truck doing these days?
My truck needs a tune-up. I'm so glad you reminded me. I left it at the airport and I said, oh, man, I'm about a month late on this.
Now,
my truck is 12 years old and it still starts up like a dream because it's the Toyota Tundra, not the little product placement in your interview. I love my truck. It's got rot on it. It needs some body work.
Don't you have a nickname for your truck?
I call it the Tundra of Love, baby.
Okay. Just checking.
I don't know why, but there you go.
The Tundra of Love as opposed to the Tunnel of Love?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. It's a Springsteen reference. And by the way, I am so grateful to Mr. Springsteen for allowing me to put, you know, eight words from Born to Run as the epigraph to the book. And he was very generous to let me do that.
Yeah, I don't think that he lets people do that stuff routinely. So that is a real compliment.
Yeah, and, you know, all I had to do was pay his lawyer time, and he just gave them to me. And I'm so grateful for that.
Well, he must like your stuff.
Well, I don't know about that, but let's just assume.
Okay. Well, Andre, I'm so glad that we were able to get you on the program. I actually tried to book you when it came out in hardcover, and so the paperback was a blessing because we had an opportunity to talk about this.
Well, Vic, I'm honored to talk to you again, man, and I really appreciate you reading the book.
You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. Our guest has been Andre DeBuse III. His book, Townie, his memoir, has just come out in paperback for The Book Nook. I'm Vic McKeonis. Thanks for listening. Next week on the program, we'll have another memoir for you. This one was written by Cambry Cruz, and it's called Burn Down the Ground. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.